Hello, hello. Welcome back to another section of A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. Sorry it's been a while that I've been away from this one, and this one is going to have to be a little bit of a shorter section just because I'm running low on time, but I wanted to get some of it read today while I do have a moment, because we can't wait any longer. It's so good. If you're new around here, hi, my name's Julie. We're reading, I read lots of books on this channel, but right now, A Gentleman in Moscow. So if you are just tuning in this video for the first time, go back, view, and catch up with us. And if you're enjoying it, hit the like and subscribe so that you get the rest of the book. All right, without any further ado, let's get started. We're on page 48 in this new chapter. The chapters aren't numbered, but this new chapter section is titled Anyway, ... 5 days later, the Count was pleased to accept a formal invitation to tea from his new acquaintance, Nina Kulikova. The engagement was for 3 o'clock in the hotel's coffee house at the northwest corner of the ground floor. Arriving at 11:45, the Count claimed a table for two near the window. When at 5 past the hour, his hostess arrived in the manner of a daffodil, wearing a light yellow dress with a dark yellow sash, the Count rose and held out her chair. "Merci," she said. "Je t'en prie." In the minutes that followed, a waiter was signaled, the samovar was ordered, and with thunderclouds accumulating over Theater Square, remarks were exchanged on the bittersweet likelihood of rain. But once the tea was poured and the tea cakes on the table, Nina adopted a more serious expression, intimating the time had come to speak of weightier concerns. Some might have found this transition a little abrupt or out of keeping with the hour, but not the Count. Quite to the contrary, he thought, a proper dispensing of pleasantries and a quick shift to the business at hand, utterly in keeping with the etiquette of tea, perhaps even essential to the institution. After all, every tea the Count ever had attended in response to a formal invitation had followed this pattern. Whether it took place in a drawing room overlooking the Fontanka Canal or a tea house in a public garden before the first cake was sampled, the purpose of the invitation would be laid upon the table. In fact, after a few requisite pleasantries, the most accomplished of hostesses could signal the transition with a single word of her choosing. For the Count's grandmother, the word had been "now," as in, "Now, Alexander, I have heard some very distressing things about you, my boy." For Princess Polyakova, a perennial victim of her own heart, it had been, "Oh," as in, "Oh, Alexander, I have made a terrible mistake." And for young Nina, the word was apparently "anyway," as in, "You're right. You're absolutely right, Alexander Ilyich. Another afternoon of rain and the lilac blossoms won't stand fighting chance. Anyway." Suffice it to say, when Nina's tone shifted, the Count was ready. Resting his forearms on his thighs and leaning forward an angle of 70 degrees, he adopted an expression that was serious yet neutral, so that in an instant he could convey his sympathy, concern, or shared indignation as the circumstances required. "I would be ever so grateful," Nina continued, "if you would share with me some of the rules of being a princess." "The rules? Yes, the rules. But Nina," the Count said with a smile, "being a princess is not a game." Nina stared at the Count with an expression of patience. "I am certain that you know what I mean. Those things that were expected of a princess." "Ah, yes, I see." The Count leaned back to give his hostess's inquiry a more appropriate consideration. "Well," he said after a moment, "setting aside the study of the liberal arts, which we discussed the other day, I suppose the rules of being a princess would begin with a refinement of manners. To that end, she would be taught how to comport herself in society. She would be taught terms of address, table manners, posture." Having nodded favorably at the various items on the Count's list, Nina looked up sharply at the last one. "Posture? Is posture a type of manners?" "Yes," replied the Count, albeit a little tentatively, "it is. A slouching posture tends to suggest a certain laziness of character, as well as a lack of interest in others, whereas an upright posture can confirm a sense of self-possession and a quality of engagement, both of which are befitting of a princess." Apparently swayed by this argument, Nina sat a little more upright. Go on. The Count reflected. A princess would be raised to show respect for her elders. Nina bowed her head toward the Count in deference. He coughed. I wasn't referring to me, Nina. After all, I'm practically a youth like yourself. No, by elders, I meant the gray-haired. Nina nodded to express her understanding. You mean the Grand Duke and Grand Duchesses? Well, yes, certainly them, but I mean elders of every social class. The shopkeepers and milkmaids, blacksmiths and peasants. Never hesitant to express her sentiments with facial expressions, Nina frowned. The Count elaborated. The principle here is that a new generation owes a measure of thanks to every member of that previous generation. Our elders planted fields and fought in wars. They advanced the arts and sciences, and generally made sacrifices on our behalf. So by their efforts, however humble, they have earned a measure of our gratitude and respect. As Nina still looked unconvinced, the Count considered how best to make his point. And so it happened that at this very moment, through the great windows of the coffee house, could be seen the first hoisting of umbrellas. An example, he said. Thus commenced the story of Princess Golitsyn and the crone of Kudrovo. One stormy night in St. Petersburg. Related the Count. Young Princess Golitsyn was on her way to the annual ball at the Tushins, and her carriage crossed over the Lomonosov Bridge. She happened to notice an 80-year-old woman on foot hunched against the rain. Without a second thought, she called for her driver to stop the carriage and invited the unfortunate soul inside. The old woman, who was nearly blind, climbed aboard with the footman's help and thanked the princess profusely. In the back of the princess's mind may well have been the presumption that her passenger lived nearby. After all, how far was an old blind woman likely to journey on a night like this? But when the princess asked where the old woman was headed, she replied that she was going to visit her son, the blacksmith, in Kudrovo, more than 7 miles away. Now, the princess was already expected at the Tushins's, and in a matter of minutes, they would be passing the house, lit from cellar to ceiling, with a footman on every step. So it would have been well within the bounds of courtesy for the princess to excuse herself and send the carriage on to Kudrovo with the old woman. In fact, as they approached the Tushins's, the driver slowed the horses and looked to the princess for instruction. Here the Count paused for effect. Well, Nina asked, what did she do? She told him to drive on. The Count smiled with a touch of triumph. And what is more, when they arrived in Kudrovo and the blacksmith's family gathered round the carriage, the old woman invited the princess in for tea. The blacksmith winced, the coachman gasped, and the footman nearly fainted. But Princess Golitsyn graciously accepted the old woman's invitation and missed the Tushins's altogether. His point expertly made, the Count raised his own cup of tea, nodded once, and drank. Nina looked at him expectantly. And then? The Count returned his cup to its saucer. And then what? Did she marry the blacksmith's son? Marry the blacksmith's son? Good God, certainly not. After a glass of tea, she climbed into her carriage and headed for home. Nina mulled this over. Clearly, she thought a marriage to the blacksmith's son a more fitting conclusion. But despite the shortcomings of history, she nodded to acknowledge that the Count had delivered a well-told tale. Preferring to preserve his success, the Count opted not to share his normal coda to this delightful bit of St. Petersburg lore, that the Countess Tushin had been greeting guests under her portico when Princess Golitsyn's bright blue carriage, known the city over, slowed before the gates and then sped on. This resulted in a rift between the Golitsyns and the Tushins, and that would have taken 3 generations to repair if a certain revolution hadn't brought an end to their outrage altogether. It was a behavior befitting a princess, acknowledged Nina. Exactly, said the Count. Then he held out the tea cakes, and Nina took 2, putting 1 on her plate and 1 in her mouth. The Count was not one to call attention to the social shortcomings of acquaintances, but giddy with his story's reception, he could not resist pointing out with a smile. There is another example. Where is another example? A princess would be raised to say please when she asked for a cake and thank you when she was offered one. Nina looked taken aback and then dismissive. I can see that please would be appropriate for a princess to say when she has asked for a cake, but I can see no reason why she should have to say thank you when she has been offered one. Manners are not like bonbons, Nina. You may not choose the ones that suit you best, and you certainly cannot put the half-bitten ones back in the box. Nina eyed the Count with an expression of seasoned tolerance, and then presumably for his benefit, spoke a little more slowly. I understand that a princess should say please if she is asking for a cake, but because she is trying to convince someone to give her the cake. And I suppose if, having asked for a cake, she is given the cake, then she has good reason to say thank you. But in the second part of your example, the princess in question didn't ask for the cake. She was offered it. And I see no reason why she should have to say thank you when she's merely obliging someone by accepting what they've offered. To punctuate her point, Nina put a lemon tartlet in her mouth. I concede that there is some merit to your argument, said the Count, but I can only tell you from a life of experience that Nina cut him off with a wave of her finger. But you have just said that you are quite young.
Indeed I am.
Well, then it seems to me that your claim of a life of experience may be premature. Yes, thought the Count, as this tea was making perfectly clear. I shall work upon my posture, Nina said definitively, brushing the crumbs from her fingers, and I will be sure to say please and thank you whenever I ask for things, but I have no intention of thanking people for things I never asked for in the first place. Page 54. Around and About. On the 12th of July, at 7 o'clock, as the Count was crossing the lobby on his way to the Boyarsky, Nina caught his eye from behind one of the potted plants and gave him the signal. It was the first time that she had hailed him for an excursion this late in the day. Quick, she explained, when he had joined her behind the tree, the gentleman has gone out to dine. The gentleman. To avoid drawing attention to themselves, the two walked casually up the stairs, but as they turned onto the third floor, they ran smack into a guest who was patting his pockets for a key. On the landing directly across from the elevator, there was a stained glass window of long-legged birds waiting in the shallows that the Count had passed 1,000 times before. Nina began to study it with care. Yes, you are right, she said. It is some kind of crane. But as soon as the guest had let himself into his room, Nina forged ahead. Moving at a brisk pace along the carpet, they passed rooms 313, 314, and 315. They passed the little table with the statue of Hermes that stood outside the door 316. Then, with a certain dizziness, the Count realized that they were headed toward his old suite. But wait, we are ahead of ourselves. After the ill-fated night that ended on the second floor steps, the Count had taken a break from his nightly aperitif, suspecting that the liquor had been an unhealthy influence on his mood. But this saintly abstinence did not prove a tonic to his soul. With so little to do, and all the time in the world to do it, the Count's peace of mind continued to be threatened by a sense of ennui, that dread mire of the human emotions. Ennui? E-N-N-U-I. And if this is how desultory one feels after 3 weeks, reflected the Count, and how desultory can one expect to feel after 3 years? But for the virtuous who have lost their way, the fates often provide a guide. On the island of Crete, Theseus had his Ariadne and her magical ball of thread to lead him safely from the lair of the Minotaur, through those caverns where ghostly shadows dwell. Odysseus had his Tiresias, just as Dante had his Virgil, and in the Metropole Hotel, Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov had a 9-year-old girl by the name of Nina Kolokova. From the first Wednesday in July, as the Count sat in the lobby at a loss of what to do with himself, he happened to notice Nina zipping past with an unusually determined expression. Hello, my friend. Where are you headed? Turning about like one who has been caught in the act, Nina composed herself, then answered with a wave of the hand. Around and about. The Count raised his eyebrows. And where is that exactly? At this moment, the card room. Ah, so you like to play cards?
Not really.
Then why on earth are you going there?
...
Oh, come now, the Count protested. Surely there are not going to be secrets between us.
Nina weighed the Count's remarks, then looked once to her left and once to her right. She confided. She explained that while the card room was rarely used, at 3 o'clock on Wednesdays, four women met there without fail for a regular game of whist. And if you arrived by 2:30 and hid in the cupboard, you could hear every word, which included a good deal of cursing. And when the ladies left, you could eat the rest of their cookies.
The Count sat upright. Where else do you spend your time?
Again, she weighed the Count's remark, looked left, looked right.
Meet me here, she said, tomorrow at 2:00.
And thus began the Count's education.
Having lived at the Metropole for 4 years, the Count considered himself something of an expert on the hotel. He knew its staff by name, its services by experience, and the decorative styles of its suites by heart. But once Nina had taken him in hand, he realized what a novice he had been. In the 10 months that Nina had lived at the Metropole, she had been confronted by her own version of confinement. For as her father had been posted only temporarily to Moscow, he had not bothered to enroll her in school. And as Nina's governess had one foot firmly set in the hinterlands, she preferred that her charge remain on the hotel's premises, where she was less likely to be corrupted by street lamps and trolley cars. So, if the door of the Metropole was known the world over for spinning without stop, it spun not for Nina. But an enterprising and tireless spirit, the young lady had made the most of her situation by personally investigating the hotel until she knew every room, its purpose, and how it might be put to better use. Yes, the Count had gone to the little window at the back of the lobby to ask for his mail. He had been to the sorting room where the incoming envelopes were spilled on a table at 10 and at 2, including those that were stamped in red with the unambiguous instruction for immediate delivery. And yes, he had visited Fatima's in the days when it was open, but had been he'd been inside the cutting room through a narrow door at the back of her shop. Was that niche with a light green counter where stems had been snipped and roses dethorned, where even now one could find scattered across the floor the dried petals of 10 perennials essential to the making of potions.
Of course, exclaimed the Count to himself. Within the Metropole there were rooms behind rooms and doors behind doors, the linen closets, the laundries, the pantries, the switchboard. It was like sailing on a steamship.
Having enjoyed an afternoon shooting clay pigeons off the starboard bow, because I think that's part of a ship, right? A passenger dresses for dinner, dines at the captain's table, outplays the cocky French fellow at baccarat, and then strolls under the stars in the arm of a new acquaintance, all the while congratulating himself that he has made the most of a journey at sea. But in point of fact, he has only exposed himself to a glimpse of life on the ship, having utterly ignored those lower levels that teem with life and make the passage possible. Nina had not contented herself with the views from the upper decks. She had gone below, behind, around, about. In the time that Nina had been in the hotel, the walls had not grown inward. They had grown outward, expanding in scope and intricacy. In her first weeks, the building had grown to encompass the life of 2 city blocks. In her first months, it had grown to encompass half of Moscow. If she lived in the hotel long enough, it would encompass all of Russia. To initiate the Count's course of study, Nina quite sensibly began at the bottom. The basement and its networks of corridors and cul-de-sacs. Tugging open a heavy steel door, she led him first into the boiler room, where billows of steam escaped from a concertina of valves. With the aid of the Count's handkerchief, she gingerly opened a small cast iron door in the furnace to reveal that the fire that burned day and night
and which happened to be the best place in the hotel to destroy secret messages and illicit love letters. You do receive illicit love letters, Count? Most certainly. Next was the electrical room, where Nina's admonition that the Count touched nothing was quite unnecessary, since the metallic buzzing and sulfurous smell would have counseled caution to the most reckless of adventurers. There, on the back wall, amidst a confusion of wires, Nina showed him the very lever that, when pulled, could throw the ballroom into darkness, providing perfect cover for the snatching of pearls. After a turn to the left and two to the right, they came to a small, cluttered room, a sort of cabinet of curiosities, showcasing all the items that the hotel's guests had left behind, such as umbrellas, Baedekers, and the weighty novels they had yet to finish but could no longer bear to lug about. While tucked away in the corner, looking no worse for wear, were two small oriental rugs, a standing lamp, and the small satinwood bookcase that the Count had abandoned in his old suite. At the far end of the basement, as the Count and Nina approached the narrow back stair, they passed a bright blue door. "What do we have here?" asked the Count. Nina looked uncharacteristically flummoxed. "I don't think I've been inside." The Count tried the knob. "Well, I'm afraid it's locked." But Nina looked left and looked right. The Count followed suit. Then she raised her hands under her hair and unhooked the delicate chain that she wore around her neck. Dangling at the bottom of the golden parabola was the pendant the Count had first observed at the piazza, but it was neither a lucky charm nor a locket. It was a passkey for the hotel. Nina slid the key from its chain and handed it to the Count so that he could do the honors, slipping it through the skull-shaped hole in the escutcheon. The Count turned gently and listened as the tumblers fell into place with a satisfying click. Then he opened the door and Nina gasped, for inside there was a treasure trove, quite literally. On shelves that lined the walls from floor to ceiling was the hotel's silver service, shimmering as if it had been polished that very morning. "What is it all for?" she asked in amazement. "For banquets," replied the Count. Alongside the stacks of Sevres, plates bearing the hotel's insignia were samovars that stood 2 feet tall and soup tureens that looked like goblets of the gods. There were coffee pots and gravy boats. There was an assortment of utensils, each of which had been designed with the greatest care to serve a single culinary purpose. From among them, Nina picked up what looked like a delicate spade with a plunger and an ivory handle. Depressing the lever, Nina watched as the two opposing blades opened and shut. Then she looked to the Count in wonder. "An asparagus server," he explained. "Does a banquet really need an asparagus server?"
"Does an orchestra need a bassoon?"
As Nina returned it gently to the shelf, the Count wondered how many times he had been served by that implement. How many times had he eaten off these plates? The bicentennial of St. Petersburg had been celebrated in the Metropole's ballroom, as had the centennial of Pushkin's birth and the annual dinner of the Backgammon Club. And then there were more intimate gatherings that took place in the 2 private dining rooms adjacent to the Boyarsky, the Yellow and Red Rooms. In their heyday, these retreats were so conducive to frank expressions of sentiment that if one were to eavesdrop at their table for a month, one would be able to anticipate all of the bankruptcies, weddings, and wars of the year to come. The Count let his eyes wander over the shelves, then shook his head to express a sense of mystification. "Surely the Bolsheviks have discovered this windfall. I wonder why it wasn't carted off." Nina responded with the unclouded judgment of a child. "Perhaps they need it here." "Yes," thought the Count, "that is it precisely." For however decisive the Bolsheviks' victory had been over the privileged classes on behalf of proletariat, they would be having banquets soon enough. Perhaps there would not be as many as there had been under the Romanovs, no autumn dances or diamond jubilees, but they were bound to celebrate something, whether the centennial of Das Kapital, or The Silver Anniversary of Lenin's Beard. Guest lists would be drawn up and shortened, invitations would be engraved and delivered. Then, having gathered around a grand circle of tables, the new statesmen would nod their heads in order to indicate to a waiter, without interrupting the long-winded fellow on his feet, that, yes, they would have a few more spears of asparagus. For pomp is a tenacious force, and a wily one, too. How humbly it bows its head as the emperor is dragged down the steps and tossed in the street. But then, having quietly bided its time while helping the newly appointed leader on with his jacket, it compliments his appearance and suggests the wearing of a medal or two. Or, having served him at a formal dinner, it wonders aloud if a taller chair might not have been more fitting for a man with such responsibilities. The soldiers of the common man may toss the banners of the old regime on the victory pyre, but soon enough, trumpets will blare and pomp will take its place at the side of the throne, having once again secured its dominion over history and kings. Nina was running her fingers over the various serving implements with a blend of admiration and awe. Then she came to a stop. What is that? On the shelf behind a candelabra stood a 3-inch-tall woman fashioned from silver with the hooped skirt and towering hair of a Marie Antoinette. It's a summoner, said the Count. A summoner? To be placed on the table beside the hostess. The Count picked up the little lady by her bouffant, and when he waggled her to and fro out from under her skirt came that delightful jangle at high C that had prompted the end of 1,000 courses at the clearing of 50,000 plates. And the clearing of 50,000 plates. In the days that followed, Nina presented her curriculum systematically, leading her student from room to room. At the onset, the Count had assumed that all their classes would be held on the hotel's lower levels, where its services were housed. But having visited the basement, the mailroom, the switchboard, and all the other nooks on the first floor, one afternoon, they proceeded up the staircase to the suites. Now, admittedly, the exploration of private apartments represents something of a break with decorum, but Nina's interest in visiting the rooms was not thievery, nor was it snooping, per se. It was the views. Each of the rooms of the Metropole offered an entirely different perspective, one that was shaped not only by the altitude and orientation, but by season and time of day. Thus, if by chance one cared to watch the battalions marching toward Red Square on the 7th of November, one should go no further than room 322. But when one wished to drop snowballs on unsuspecting strollers, this was best accomplished from the deep-ledged windows of 405, even room 244, a rather depressing little spot overlooking the alley behind the hotel, had its allure, for from there, if one leaned far enough out of the window, one could watch the fruit sellers gather at the kitchen door and catch the occasional apple tossed from below. But if one wished to watch the arrival of guests at the Bolshoi on a summer night, the best vantage point, without question, was the northwest window of 317. And so. On the 12th of July at 7 o'clock, as the Count was crossing the lobby, Nina caught his eye and gave him the signal. 2 minutes later, having joined her on the stairs, he was trailing her past rooms 313, 314, and 315 toward the door of his old suite. And when Nina turned the key and slipped inside, the Count dutifully followed, but with a palpable sense of foreboding. In a glance, the Count reacquainted himself with every inch of the room. Couch and chairs upholstered in red remained, as did the grandfather clock and the large Chinese urns from Idle Hour. On the French coffee table that had been supplied to replace his grandmother's was a folded copy of Pravda, a silver service, and an unfinished cup of tea. Quick, she said again, as she padded across the room to the window at the northwest corner. Across Theater Square, the Bolshoi was lit from portico to pediment. The Bolsheviks, who, as usual, were dressed like the cast of La Boheme, were taking advantage of the warm night air by mingling among the columns. Suddenly, the lights in the lobby flickered. Scuffing out their cigarettes, the men took the ladies by their elbow. But just as the last of the attendees was disappearing through the doors, a taxi pulled to the curb. The door flung open, and a woman in red dashed up the stairs with the hem of her dress in her hands. Leaning forward, Nina cupped her palms against the glass and squinted. If only I were there and she were here, she sighed. And there, thought the Count, was a suitable plaint for all mankind. Page 61, after the star. Later that night, as he sat alone on his bed, the Count mulled over his visit to his old suite. What had stayed with him was not the sight of his family's clock still ticking by the door, nor the grandeur of the architecture, nor even the view from the northwest window. What had lingered with him was the sight of the tea service on the table beside the folded paper. That little tableau, for all its innocence, was somehow suggestive of exactly what had been bearing down on the Count's soul, for he understood every aspect of the scene at a glance. Having returned from some outing at 4 o'clock and having hung his jacket on the back of a chair, the room's current resident had called for tea and an afternoon edition. Then he had settled himself down on the couch to while away a civilized hour before it was time to dress for dinner. In other words, what the Count had observed in Suite 317 was not simply an afternoon tea, but a moment in the daily life of a gentleman at liberty. In light of these thoughts, the Count reviewed his new room, the 100 square feet that had been assigned to him. Never had it seemed so small. The bed crowded the coffee table crowded the high-back chair, and the high-back chair had to be shoved aside every time one wished to open the closet. Simply put, there was not enough space to accommodate such a civilized hour. But as the Count gazed around him with this forlorn thought, a voice only half his own reminded him that in the Metropole there were rooms behind rooms and doors behind doors. Rising from his bed, the Count navigated his way around his grandmother's coffee table, set aside the high-back chair, and stood before his telephone box of a closet. Running along the perimeter of where the closet met the wall was an elegant molding. The Count had always thought this flourish a little excessive, but what if the closet had been built in an old doorframe? Opening the door, the Count parted his clothes and tentatively rapped on the back wall. Sound was promisingly thin. With 3 fingers, he gave the barrier a push and could feel it flex. He took all his jackets out and dumped them on the bed. Then, holding the jambs of the door, he kicked the inner wall with his heel. There came a pleasant crack. Leaning back, he kicked again and again until the barrier splintered. Then he pulled the jagged planks back into his room and slipped through the gap. He was now inside a dark, narrow space that smelled of dry cedar, presumably the interior of a neighboring closet. Taking a breath, he turned the knob, opened the door, and entered a room that was the mirror image of his own, but in which 5 unused bed frames had been stored. At some point, 2 of the frames, which had been leaning against the wall, had fallen, pinning the hallway door shut. Pulling the frames aside, the Count opened the door, dragged everything out of the room, and began to refurnish. First, he reunited the 2 high-back chairs with his grandmother's coffee table. Then, taking the belfry stairs, he went down to the basement. From the cabinet of curiosities, he retrieved 1 of his rugs, the standing lamp, and the small bookcase in 3 separate trips. Then, vaulting the steps 2 at a time, he made 1 final visit in order to claim 10 of the weighty novels that had been abandoned. Once his new study was furnished, he went down the hall and borrowed the roofer's hammer and 5 nails. The Count had not wielded a hammer since he was a boy at idle hour, when he would help Tikhon, the old caretaker, repair the fencing in the first weeks of spring. What a fine feeling it had been, to bring the hammer down squarely on the head of a nail, driving it through a plank into a fence post as the impact echoed in the morning air. But on the very first stroke of this hammer, what the count squarely hit was the back of his thumb. Lest you have forgotten, it is quite excruciating to hammer the back of your thumb. It inevitably prompts a hopping up and down and the taking of the Lord's name in vain. But fortune does favor the bold. So while the next swing of the hammer glanced on the nail's head, on the third, the count hit home, and by the second nail, he had recovered the rhythm of set, drive, and sink, that ancient cadence which is not to be found in quadrilles or hexameters or in Vronsky's saddlebags. Suffice it to say that within half an hour, four of the nails had been driven through the edge of the door in the doorframe, such that from that moment forward, the only access to the count's new room would be through the sleeves of his jackets. The fifth nail he saved for the wall above the bookcase so that he could hang the portrait of his sister. His work completed, the count sat down in one of the high back chairs and felt an almost surprising sense of bliss. The count's bedroom and this improvised study had identical dimensions, and yet they exerted a completely different influence on his mood. To some degree, this difference stemmed from the manner in which the two rooms had been furnished, for while the room next door, with its bed, bureau, and desk, remained a realm of practical necessities, the study, with its books, the ambassador, and Helena's portrait, had been furnished in a manner more essential to the spirit. But in all likelihood, a greater factor in the difference between the two rooms was their provenance. For if a room that exists under the governance, authority, and intent of others seems smaller than it is, then a room that exists in secret can, regardless of its dimensions, seem as vast as one cares to imagine. Rising from his chair, the count took up the largest of the 10 volumes that he had retrieved from the basement. True, it would not be a new venture for him, but need it be? Could one possibly accuse him of nostalgia or idleness, of wasting his time simply because he had read the story two or three times before? Sitting back down, the count put one foot on the edge of the coffee table and tilted back until his chair was balanced on its two hind legs. Then he turned to the opening sentence. All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Marvelous, said the count. And we're going to stop there, starting with page 65 next time, just in time for these sirens. Apologies for the sweet noise. I do like to pause when it gets a little too loud because I don't want us to miss anything. But yeah, he's about to read Anna Karenina. I just read that last year, so I recognize that first line. All right, hope you are enjoying this one. I certainly am. That was so exciting getting to see all the back rooms and stuff of this hotel. All right, I'll catch you next time. Bye.